Hey guys, quick intro, new episode here. We recorded outside today in Yellow Springs. Me and Luke Capasso, today's guest. It's a little bit windy, but I did a lot of editing, and I think I knocked most of it out of the sound barrier. So if you turn it way up, you'll probably hear it. But if you keep it at a reasonable level, you don't damage your earballs. Should be fine. Just wanted to say thank you and sorry for such a long hiatus, but I think s coming up on 100 episodes, we've noticed that about every 30 or 40 episodes, I tend to get a little bit of a burnout where I just can't bring myself to record. Well, in this little break, I did bring myself to record several times, but I just didn't feel like they were strong enough to post. It's kind of a bummer doing it by myself. And Luke just got back from Edinburgh, Scotland. And I thought this would be a great chance to talk to him. He's never been on the cast before. And I really enjoyed sitting down talking to him. And hopefully you do too. Please follow, like, comment, all that good stuff. And I'm back, feeling better. And going into this weekend here with at the Dayton Funny Bone. And then I hit the road again for the rest of the month. So. Blue skies ahead, I guess. I don't know if I've been depressed in the last few weeks or if I've just been relaxing or what, but I'm starting to feel creative again. Wrote some stuff today that I'm pretty happy with, so I'll be trying that out all weekend. That's the mission. And I've been running again, and times are coming down. I'm under 25 minutes for a 5K. I'm trying to get it under 20. It's been elusive, but I haven't been drinking, and I've been doing pretty good. The last week, being a responsible adult. So hopefully that continues. It's going to continue because I have at least the smallest modicum of willpower. Keep that running. Send me any requests. Send me a message. Let me know what you want to hear, what you want to do, and we'll put it up. Hope you're having a great week, and we'll be back next week with a new episode. Love you. Stay by. Here comes the rest of the episode. Sitting here with Luke, I don't even know how to pronounce your last name. I always say asshole, but I think it might be mispronouncing. What is it?
A lot of people pronounce it that way, but I usually go with Capasso.
Capasso. Okay.
Sometimes Capasso. I got
Capasso.
That wrong.
Capasso. I feel like when I'm being southern, I want to say Capasso.
Depends on what part of the country. Yeah, East Coast there, Capasso's.
What? How do Italians say it?
Capasso.
Capasso. Are you Italian?
Like Pizza Hut.
A Pizza Hut Italian.
Right. Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stuffed crust.
I'm the one. I'm the you know, the one that's got the wiener dogs wrapped in the pigs in the blanket in the crust. That's the one I am.
That's me.
That's the kind of Italian I practice.
The part of Italy I'm from there.
Yeah, the Vienna.
Yeah, with chicken ranch, bacon on the top.
Lots of bacon. We were just talking. I said I switched. I just recently switched. Some listeners may know that I switched from Android to iPhone. And you, as I was telling you that, you told me you went the other way and you switched from iPhone to Android. So my first question was, what version of iPhone were you on when you switched?
The last one I was on was the 5.
The 5. Okay, yeah. So that's...
The Cinco.
The Cinco. That was a smaller, brickier version than... Was it thin like this one?
It was thin like that.
Okay.
Yeah, but it wasn't as sleek. Looking, it was like the more, yeah, I
had
guess
curvier edges, maybe with sharper
with
edge,
the aluminum bit around the edge.
All right.
Yeah,
yeah, that's what I remembered of the iPhone. And I remember originally the iPhone just seemed too small, and I was like, you know, originally there was just one kind of iPhone, you know, maybe a couple different color variations, but I always was like, I have big hand, I like bigger text, or I want more modification, so I'm just going to stick with the Android. But
you're watching porn on it, you got to hold it right up to your eyeball.
Right up to the eyeball, that's not good. You know, they say when you're watching porn, you want to be at least 2 to 3 feet away. I mean, otherwise,
yeah, or you will
porn?
Go blind.
Yeah, you will go blind. I mean, I'm not trying to hold my phone either. That's why I use like that silly putty stuff, and I just stick it to the glass, like at the coffee shop, I just stick it right up there.
So what are your thoughts going the opposite direction from iPhone to Android? Are you happy or less happy? I see you have your phone on a concrete surface face down.
Well, it's got the little rim on the... I think I'm... I hated iTunes. I hate when I have to, like, to... Well, I just want to add one song or do whatever. It was like you needed to pass an algebra test just to figure out how to just add a song or delete a song or make a playlist. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to take a class just to listen to music on my thing.
Are you a phone junkie?
Not really, but I do use it to make... Occasionally, I'll make little videos, and I'll take part of it off the... Because it's still 1080p camera.
Right.
And, again, with the iPhone... You have to do all this ring-a-maroo to get it off to your...
Yes, that's the one thing I haven't tried to do yet, but to get the videos off, you got to share it to something and then get it from that something.
Yeah, I want to just plug it in like it's a hard drive and then pull it off.
Me too, that's what I'm used to. That'll be...
But other than that, I don't really use... Occasionally I use internet, I use maps, I use the camera, I use the voice recorder. So I don't get into all this other kind of shenanigans. So I've been happy with it. So it took a little bit to adjust... using the Samsung.
Did you save money in the Switch?
No, I don't think I got a very good deal on my phone, really. Well, I got my kid's phone on there too, so.
Okay, yeah, that's what I just did with my son too. I was gonna go to like a discount service or like Verizon prepaid, but when I realized, I was like, I gotta get him a phone that's kind of updated. And he's been rocking the same phone since I got him a phone, and that was like 4 years ago. So, and he's taken great care of it, so I had no reason to believe. Well, other than the fact that I did get him a new phone, and he broke it in 2 weeks.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. And then I was like, and then he took his old phone, and he's kept that in immaculate condition. So I don't know if that new phone was just a pussy, but I gave him my old Droid, and now I got this iPhone. It doesn't play with my car as well through Bluetooth.
All right.
The GPS won't work when I'm listening to a podcast. It'll work when I'm listening to music, but it won't work when I'm listening to a podcast. And I mostly listen to podcasts, so I'm like... That's almost a deal breaker for a guy who drives as much as I do.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And who is as dyslexic as I am, because I can't even go anywhere without GPS anymore, it seems like. But I'm not happier switching from Android to iPhone. I'm less happy, if anything, because it's not as convenient as it once was. But I think I could overcome some of that with familiarity and just getting used to it. I've already learned a few tricks.
Once you figure it out, because it was hard. It's like... like you're speaking a different language almost.
Yeah. It's like, I know this language, but I'm not fluent yet.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you're still saying things like, Mike can go to store. And like, I'm sorry. The one thing I found, and I guess I haven't set up Siri to recognize my personal voice yet, or let it be able to search the internet or something. But every time I'm like, hey Siri, the only thing Siri does for me accurately is set an alarm. But like, I could okay Google just about everything and get a written or a rote or a spoken response. And I'd be like, hey Siri, what's... It never gets what I'm saying. It always like, it's like, oh, I'll tell you what George McGovern said last week. I'm like, that's not what I... I asked, how long does MDMA stay in your system?
Yeah. See, mine used to, it was like talking to me when I first got it. I had to figure, actually my son had to show me how to shut off the... So I'd just be having a conversation and be like, what did you say?
I'm
not fucking talking to you, phone. Like, I'm not, all the time it was, I'll look that up for you. It's like, you just relax. Right. It's not about you.
One of my funniest things I ever heard, I was listening to Joe Rogan's podcast, and Ari Shaffir was like, hey Siri, look up how to make a bomb. He's like, and everybody's phone is just switching off right now.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh wow, I wouldn't like that. But I've had that same thing happen with OK Google. I think anytime that's always listening is kind of a creepy.
Yeah.
I'm not into all that, but it is. I haven't figured out how to shut it off yet. I haven't tried. It hasn't interrupted one of my conversations yet.
I was talking to, this is kind of exciting parties I go to. We were discussing how to fix a garbage disposal.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I just look it up on YouTube, and that's how I learned. And then the next day, suggested for you all these garbage disposal videos on YouTube. I was like, phone, you are creepy as fuck.
That's not cool.
Yeah, that shit was in my pocket. It wasn't even like,
That's the thing I don't like about AdSense and stuff like that. I'll frequently buy something online, and if I buy anything online, I've done my research. I'm getting it for like, I'll buy it like outside of the box.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like if it's $30 cheaper to get it because open box or you know, only jizzed on once, I'll take it for a discount. But then it'll show me these AdSense commercials for the thing I just bought at a more expensive price. And I'm thinking to myself, like, if you know well enough to know that I saw these websites, then why don't you know that I saw it at a much better price already?
Yeah.
It seems like if you were showing me competitive prices, that would be interesting, but you're showing me info on something that I already got, and you're just making me feel like a genius for having not paid that much.
Maybe they're just trying to make you feel better.
Maybe that's what it is.
Maybe you're under some survey, like to boost your self-esteem.
Maybe that's why Americans think they're so smart these days.
Yeah. And then now it's in their... gauging it because you're clicking love on everything because you're in this great mood and you're like,
right, like, well, I just saved a bunch of money by not buying it from these jagoffs.
Yeah, now that's, I love this guy's status of his lunch, you know what I mean?
How'd your phone work overseas just recently?
Actually, it was kind of, well, first it was a bit of a pain in the ass, but I found it liberating, really, because
to not be
just turn that thing off, and if I just had to go to Wi-Fi and use it. But they have this thing called, which is way easier than coming back this way. It has a thing called GiftGaff, and you get like a monthly SIM card. And you just go, and it's like, yeah, you just go and you pay your, it was like £14, which would be now $14, I guess, $14-15. And yeah, then you're covered for the month. So,
oh, that's like unlimited talk?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That works.
And I just, for the most part, I would, because I was still nervous about it, because I'm going to come back to a Sprint bill that was.
You owe $2 trillion.
Yeah, I would just get in, either get in, just use WhatsApp as many times to call people. Because one, they still have a UK number, so it's a pain, but yeah. But yeah, so I just use WhatsApp a lot, or good old Facebook phone call.
So tell me about your trip to Edinburgh. Did I say it right?
Yeah, you did. They actually did a lot better than most. Me, I mean, called Edinburgh.
Yeah. I like over there at Egbert.
Yeah.
I like that cartoon.
Yeah, it was good. Well, I went to London for a week, did some shows there, then I went to Edinburgh for the month, and then back to London for a week.
When you go to London, where do you stay? What part of London?
Well, I stayed with some friends this time, near King's Cross.
Okay.
This time, and then the first time I was in Crouch End.
Okay.
Sorry, no, I take that back. Croydon.
Mixed up.
They're about the same thing, really.
Okay.
I'm
a Tottenham fan, which is northern London, considered northern London, but it's well outside of what I would consider London proper.
Still greater London, really, kind of area. Yeah.
When I went last, 2 summers ago, we stayed in like the financial district right by the, what is it, the bridge?
Oh, you're down, kind of where the Tower Bridge.
Yeah, Tower Bridge. We were like walking distance to the Tower. Well, it was the cheapest, actually. I think because it was we were in the middle of summer or whatever, and so it was much more desirable to stay down like where the sites are.
Yeah.
We took a tour, and like one of those cab tours, and it was pretty amazing seeing all that history. And what it did was, my sister always said, she's like, Americans, we don't have any sense of history. And I'm always like, no, we do.
We just
it's just
it
a different sense of history. But when you're in London, you really do understand how somebody could say that. It's kind of ostentatious for an American to say that Americans don't have a sense of history. But what I got was like standing in places that had been around since like the 1600s.
Well, I would say culturally we're a little bit different. Like when I first came back, I still had culture shock coming back to. I was over there for 7 years, and then I came back. I went to the Funny Bone in Dayton, and none of that was there. The whole town wasn't even there. And a guy I was talking to was like, isn't this great? All this new, I was like, this looks like a Disney fake village. We have a nice historical downtown, which we're terrified of. And so we created a fake one. And for us, like, we were like, this building's brand new. Isn't it amazing? Look, it's a brand new building. But for me, I'm like, if the building's not going to be around, or it's going to need totally redone in 5-10 years, you didn't do a very good job. I mean, that's my thought on it. But you have this building that it's 200 years old, and it's still up, and it's still running, and it's still beautiful, and it's now become timeless. That's, to me, is a nice building. But
Well, you know, it's amazing, though, because London is one of those places that it's like, I think because real estate is such a premium that they're always tearing shit down and rebuilding. Like, when I was there, the skyline was littered with cranes.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably true in a lot of cities, but I've never seen construction on this scale, like active tearing down, active building of like some of the most futuristic buildings I've ever seen in my life.
Well, they're kind of at a weird, they've been at this sort of weird turning point for the past 10 to 15 years where it's a lot of foreign investors and it's so expensive to live in the city. A lot of the city's bought up by like wealthy Russians and Saudis, and people that have lived in neighborhoods forever can't afford to live in it.
Right.
And, they're just putting in these huge people that are doing that aren't necessarily Londoners.
Right.
They just are making the money off of it. And like I said, there's a big kind of backlash from it, but because there's a big fight. They're like, this London's starting to look like Dubai.
Yeah.
To make it look
yeah.
like this.
That's kind of what I felt like too.
Yeah, especially down where you were staying.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you get up in like Camden and all those kind of areas, I mean, they're still ripping stuff down.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to make
I mean, I still like within walking distance, there was still like cobblestone markets and stuff that was like, Jesus, this has been around since fucking before Harry Potter. But it seems like it was almost like, this is where we come from.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like when I was like visiting some of these historical sites, like this is where it all fucking kind of started for Americans, at least unless you're Native American, in which case then standing in there would have been like, I could burn it all down. I don't know what the feelings of would be. Yeah. But so you were in London for a couple weeks and then headed over to the old Scots of the Landy.
Festival.
And so what was that like? Talk about that.
This would be my seventh festival I went to. They do this big arts festival. It's the largest performing arts festival in the world. It's heavy duty, man.
Have you been to the street fair here in Yellow Springs?
That's impressive.
Impressive. Right, I just want to make sure that you're okay.
For what the street fair is for lesbian arts and crafts, that's what that is for performing arts.
Oh, okay. So it's not just comedy.
No. Well, I mean, it's sort of taken over, but no, it's not just comedy.
What's the most fringy thing that you
they
saw?
They do have kind of, I mean, they got like a, what a, let's see, the weirdest thing this year.
Donkey show?
I wish. Let's see, the weirdest thing I saw this year, I saw some sort of Chinese street ballet thing called Monkey Dance. It was pretty cool. It took a little minute to get into it. One year I went and there was a lady. I usually try to see three shows at least a day. I'll see a friend show, then I might go see a pro show. Excuse me. And then there's people just handing out flyers all the time. Hey, come see my show, and I'll just be like, give me that random thing. And usually, a lot of times, it's terrible. Which is what I like. Mm-hmm. And one was this woman doing this sort of one-person play about spending time in an old folks' home, and it was just her and a chair, and her, like, the chair would, the light would change colors, and it was terrible.
Like a one-person show?
Yes.
Sort of a vibe?
That wasn't vetted in any way, and no one in her life ever said anything negative to her, ever. And
that's interesting.
I loved it.
I do find comedy to be, I've said this before, comedy is kind of like the catch-all for performing arts because comedians, comedy world doesn't tell, we're not exclusionary, whereas musicians are like, well, it's got to be music, and if you're doing this kind of a show, it's got to be this kind of a music. Yeah. Now, sometimes you might have like a panacea type, all types of music or whatever, but it's got to be music in some way, shape, or form. And but comedy, it's like, we'll let musicians in, we'll let poets in, we don't even require that it be funny.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so I feel like sometimes the desire to express yourself exceeds the necessity of it being entertaining.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a personal thing, right? If I'm like, I got these things I need to say, but other people are like, I don't understand what the fuck you're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
The performer can still be like, that's not important.
Yeah. That's your problem.
That's your problem. That's like the comedian's ethos. If you don't enjoy what I'm doing, that's your problem. Whereas with a musician, you can't get much traction being bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Or horrible. You know, because people are like, ah.
The only thing I would get, which what hurt, like music comedy-wise, one, it's also hurts the ability. Like, let's say you're the best country musician on earth, undeniably. Amazing, you're Willie Nelson on steroids, and but you're at a reggae festival, nobody wants to hear that,
right?
You know what I mean? And but however, you know how to sell yourself,
right?
I'm not gonna, but if it's comedy, there's no way you're like, well, this is the hip hop of comedy, or this is the, like, it's only in a small way can you sort of market it to a certain people.
I agree. I think we're finding more and more niche comedy now, or I wouldn't even call it niche comedy, but I would just say that. Through historically, people have been like, that guy's not funny, that guy's hilarious, or whatever. And there's crossover comics that know no limits when it comes to their audience. Their audience is literally, you couldn't pick them out of a lineup. But then there's other comics that are like, only going to draw a certain type of person.
Yeah.
They're only for a certain kind of person, and that's okay. I think because we've come to this internet age where you really can only see what you want to see, only hear things that are favorable to you or your opinions, that now we're seeing comedians really, not really even pander, but just being like, look, I'm not doing my jokes to get the most traction. I'm doing my jokes to hit the hardest with the people that already like this. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And I think it's also...
Not everybody wants to be McDonald's. Nobody wants to be
a certain... Exactly. And even amongst McDonald's, I mean, McDonald's may have... It's a great example. It's like politically even, you could be killing it as the president. If you were like the most popular president of all time, you'd have like a 56% approval rating. You know, just above half. Still failing by every measure of terms of success to be 50%, 60%, still pretty much always universally considered failing. But it's funny in that with this, all this subjectivity becoming objective, you know, like I don't like this, and so it's bad.
That guy sucks.
Your logic for what justifies the truth is how you feel about it. So that makes this festival very interesting in that they let in entertainment value may or may not be the number one.
But that's sort of what, that's kind of the beauty of it, because what they've done, there's a few different things have happened. Like for a while, it used to just be the festival fringe, and you had to apply and you got invited to go. And then some organizations started the free fringe, which is how I got my start with the festival. And that is catered toward newer acts. And but the way it sort of self-polices itself, because if you're a new act and you suck and your show's gonna suck and you go up there for a month, by the end of that month you will be like, I need to not suck because that was a terrible month of my life.
There's no way you enjoy it sucking.
I've invested this much time and energy into it, and like the first time I went up and did an hour, I wasn't ready to do an hour. And it was terrible. So I was like, if I'm doing this again, I'm gonna do it and be ready for it, or you know what I mean, or backtrack and maybe do a two-hander. So there's some people that there's a level of delusion that they don't have, but yeah. And like I said, it's still on a larger scale, it's still the same as like comedy in the Midwest. You have a reputation among your peers, like they're gonna see you, they're gonna whatever else, and word gets around like this person's either untalented or they're just a complete ass. Don't give them that space. So you have like different organizations, and they'll go to either different pubs or different, some of it's like a hotel and they make one of the like banquet rooms. There's venues everywhere, and you apply to these places for different times and different venues, and then they sort through it and they're like, this guy, we worked with him before, he's terrible, blah blah blah, or whatever else. So it does sort of, it does police itself in a way. But yeah, but the beauty of it is it gives people the opportunity to either excel or suck, and it's not.
I think it's what it really, with a month-long idea like that, is that it really gives you a whole new insight, and you're performing every day for 30 days, basically?
Well, there's one day off. We had the, and I pulled one show, but that was just because my audience was 10 Italians who barely spoke English. I'm trying to explain to them why they weren't going to enjoy it.
You perform!
Yeah, yeah. It's not a clown show. I'm not.
They're eating spaghetti.
Putting pies in the face and shit.
Yeah. I think for me, what I think doing anything every day for 30 days that you normally don't do, whether it's running, writing, reading, anything that you don't normally do. I mean, performing is something that we normally do, but we don't normally do it for 30 days straight. And not in that kind of environment, same type of room, same act or whatever, similar venue. That's 100% unique. And so whatever insight that you get at the end of it is almost sort of like an ayahuasca trip or something like that. Like, I had no idea. I had no idea what I was going to feel like. I mean, I thought I had an idea. But when you come out the other end, you're like, that was a lot different. And I think you probably have some awakenings to your act once you start doing it in other places after that. I could almost see like a PTSD sort of effect. Did you experience anything like that?
It was weird at the end because I didn't do it. I had the urge to do it, but I saw a lot of comics do it on their last show, do this whole, this has been an amazing experience, thank you so much for being here to share it with me. But the funny part of it is, is that audience just came for that one show.
Right.
They didn't were there for the whole month. They don't give a fuck what you've been through.
Right.
That is all on you.
Right.
Like the performer and somebody's like so self-absorbed.
Right.
That they don't like understand.
You guys came every day.
Yeah, yeah. That I've been through this journey all year. I've written this for you. And like, they don't give a fuck. But no, but it's because it's on a bigger, like on a smaller scale. Let's say you have the best hour headline show you've ever had. Like, it's just this, every single joke was just amazing. You're like this high that you're on. And then it's done. Like,
right.
There was no recording
right.
of it. It's just the memory of it. And you're in some little town and you're in Omaha.
Uh-huh.
And then no one, that just exists for you.
Yes.
And then you think it'll be different for you. But it's the same thing with that, but on just a month-long scale. You come out of it at the end and you're like, that was good, but...
What
I
next?
Just still have my t-shirt and suitcase to get back on the airplane. And that's kind of a, I don't know.
I would say that all the good feelings of a good show for me end when I leave the club that night or whatever the venue is that time. I mean, like, any good feelings that I had about, oh, that was a good show, oh, I made a lot of money, or, oh, that was a hot crowd, or whatever my good feelings are, they start to diminish the minute I leave that venue. And then what I'm left with the next couple of days is just the idea that the last show was good or was acceptable. But if the last show was not what I wanted it to be, then I'm really left in that space of almost like I lost a bunch of money at the poker tables and I can't feel happy about myself until I go get that money back. And so I could see, like, after 30 days, the line between winning and losing, good set, bad set, all of that starting to sort of blur together.
It's emotional. It's weird because you'll have, I did my hour show. A lot of times you'll do like 10 spots all over town. One day I did like 6-10 spots.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have a terrible hour show, like just they're just not getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next you're smashing the ass off of it in front of this huge room of like 400 people
mm-hmm.
doing a 10-minute set. And then all of a sudden, blam, you're back up again. You do another one and there's four people just staring at you drunkenly falling asleep. You're like, what am I doing with my life?
Yeah.
So you're just on this kind of up and down roller coaster. And by about week two or three, you just sort of get... numb in a good way. You're just like, I'm going to do my thing and they're going to be into it or not into it and then I'm going to be off to the next thing. And then you kind of accept that sort of coaster of it. You know?
Do you ask yourself that question a lot? What am I doing with my life?
Oh, I think if someone doesn't, they're insane.
I was just thinking that when you said that. I was like, I wonder if people that go to a regular job... Did you ask yourself that question in the Air Force?
I've asked since... I've always... Yeah, keep,
it's like a recurring
theme. Self-audit.
Yeah. I can't even like begin to think how many times a day I think that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Let alone like how long have I been? I think it started happening when I was in my 20s. I started saying like, I have a birthday, like, and I turned 20. I remember when I turned 20 and I looked back at being 19 and I thought, God, I thought I knew so much last year. I thought I was so smart. And compared to just what I've learned in the last year, it's like maybe 100% more than what I knew last year.
Yeah.
And I felt that way almost every year of my life.
Yeah.
Maybe since I got to be like in my late 30s, it wasn't like I know twice as much, but still kind of like since comedy, once I started doing comedy, it kicked in overdrive because like, you know, your first year in comedy, somebody be like, hey, we want you to headline this bar show. And you're like, yeah, no, I could do that. And you're like, no, you don't know. You can't do that.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Physically and literally you can do that, but you don't know that you shouldn't do that or that that's not a good idea for you to stretch that far.
Yeah.
Some people probably could pull it off and nobody would be the wiser. But I remember my first year in comedy watching people set up shows and they would feature. They would feature and they would say things like, they'd be like, Adrian, can you host? And I'd be like, well, I have no problem hosting, but you struggle with 10 minutes and you're going to do 20.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I just want to, you know, I don't get the opportunity to do it very often. And I'm thinking to myself, like, that's because you don't have that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I'll do this, but it's going to look even worse if I do well and you go up and do worse
just
behind
it
me.
Yeah.
I never understood people structuring their shows to benefit their growth needs, but I do understand it now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's almost like, oh, well, yeah, it's almost like you're going to have two prostitutes. It's like, well, I never have the chance to have sex with two women.
Yeah.
Of course I'm going to take this opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think at the time I was just thinking like everybody should think about this the way I do, which is put the show first and your emotions second. And so I would end up saying what I think people would interpret as being an asshole, but I'm just really being honest. You know what I mean? Like, no, you shouldn't.
But part of the time, I think being honest or seeming like an asshole is less of an asshole thing to do. Like,
saying the hard truth?
Yeah. Like, even like, they used to run that terrible show at the GOAT, right?
You don't do that anymore?
Yeah, not for a bit. So while I was over,
is somebody still
overseas.
Doing it there?
No, I'm debating on. They do the Thursday thing.
What is Thursday? Just like an open mic?
Open mic. Okay. Thing. I mean, I might do it. I mean, it was all right. The thing. It was an opportunity to give a lot of people.
A good time.
Yeah, it's a lot of people. What I liked about it is it gave most comics their first 10 minutes.
And
it gave most comics their first paid thing, even though it was like $5.
Right, right.
But there were sometimes. What I don't like about it, not say it's not a terrible show, it's an all right show. But what annoyed me is like it just had terrible comics being angry at me all the time. Like I'm somehow. But I would get denying them. Yeah. They would be like, when is it my turn to get? I was like, dude, I've not seen you complete a 5-minute set. I can't.
Right.
It's a free show. People will walk, and then it'll hurt the rest of the people.
Right.
And then now they hate me. But then some of those people, they've come back and they're like, I think if you're around, I'd like you to see you.
Sure.
So in a way, not to say like, because there's limited opportunities in Dayton, especially if you're at that level.
Right.
And a lot of these guys, they don't have cars for whatever reason. And then, so in a way, it's sort of like, if I was just like, yeah, go ahead, do 10, you know what I mean? Then they will never have saw, oh, wait a minute, just my talking is not enough, you know?
Yeah, I do.
Not to say that my approval is the, like.
Sure, no, but there's got to be some vetting process. I mean, for all of these things, even a unbooked open mic should have somebody running it with enough awareness to know that, oh, this guy pulled a knife on somebody once.
Yeah,
he can't go up. Or this guy only does other people's material. He can't go up. And I'm not saying that that person's job is to stop people from going up. It really isn't. It just is to be like, hey, if you do this, I'm not going to let you up. So I hope you got some new, you know what I mean? Karen did a great job of that at Wise, maybe to a fault. Whereas.
But I respect, because for me, especially in a small market like this, a lot of people don't go out very much. So if they go out and somebody's just yelling race, hate, or not even their own jokes or whatever else, or they're just terrible, that person's like, well, I'm never taking a chance again in my life on something I've not seen before.
Sure, and I have mixed feelings about that too, because open mic is, or like a...
I'm not like...
Not,
a,
yeah, but
a
like,
sunny,
a free show or a booked open mic of some sort, you know, and then you have a bringer show, if you will. And I always struggled with that idea about people would say, like, you know, when people leave and they're like, I'll never be back or whatever. The idea is that we are trying to capture new fans of comedy.
Yeah.
Almost like white supremacists can't survive if they're not recruiting new members.
Yeah, yeah.
And the easiest way to recruit new members is to birth them.
Yeah, yeah.
So I feel like comedy has a similar struggle, except for the fact that we're not ostracized by the world yet.
Yeah,
we're getting there, though.
But
so I guess my thought is, like, the people that say that they're never going to come back because they saw bad comedy, those weren't the people we were trying to recruit anyway. Almost like for every person that says, I'll never be back to see comedy again, it's like if you didn't understand that this is like a movie, because there's some people that are like, they go and they see a bad movie. Do they say, I'll never see a movie again?
Yeah.
Or do people go to see a play and they're like, I'll never see a live play again. That one was terrible. Or hear music, see a concert, and be like, that band sucked. I'll never go see a concert again. I mean, it's like, there are people like that.
Yeah.
And those aren't the people they're trying to capture either.
Yeah,
so it's kind of like, we're looking for the people that are like, no, I get it. That wasn't for me, but, you know, I like comedy.
Yeah.
And I think it's because we have this on-demand society now with TV. Comedy's readily available on demand on YouTube or whatever. You can see your favorite stars without ever seeing them live.
Yeah, for free.
Yeah, for free. And then you also have to contend with bad audience members who are talking, and that can ruin your experience in the club or whatever. That's not, it's an every show in some way, even if it's Steve Hofstetter who does, I mean, not to say that he's a bad comic, it's just that he does his set, like whatever set he's doing, it's word for word the same every time. But the audience is different every time.
Yeah.
And so, like, what people have to contend with as far as, like, somebody's too drunk, somebody's not drunk enough, people are like, this isn't my kind of comedy. It's like, we're really kind of going for a certain type of person, and that's the type of person that's like, oh, no, I like comedy.
Yeah.
I'll never say comedy's bad. You know what I mean? I don't like this guy, but this guy was hilarious. Those are my favorite people after shows. You don't have to tell comedians who your favorite comic was. Yeah. But the fact that you were like, it wasn't all for me, but I really like this guy. Even when it's the MC, even if it's not me and it was the MC that they really liked, I'm like, good, because this guy's got a future in comedy. That's why they put three of us up there.
Comedy smart people can, like, you can see someone die and you would be like, no, that person's actually really good. They just just had an off night. Or you can see someone crush it and you're like, no, that person's terrible. But they just
sometimes,
you know what I mean?
Like, sometimes you can, still, you can. Sometimes I've seen good comics bomb and bad comics do well. And it's not always discernible, but sometimes it really is. And I think the times that it is most discernible is when you already know the comic.
Yeah, I feel like, well, I do a lot of terrible shows. I'll do some shows in like the back of like a tractor supply store.
Oh, we all do a lot of terrible shows.
And you'll see somebody go up there that's like just basically reading jokes off the internet.
Right.
And they'll be crushing.
Right.
Like, oh, they're going to
love crushing for the wrong reason.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, this next person's going to wipe the floor with them. So they, like, they're actually got things to say, and people are like, just turn right off. And
you're
like, no, it's your fault this time. Normally, I don't blame the audience, but sometimes you can look at it and be like, no, you don't know what you're looking at.
Yeah, that is. And I think I've seen that one time I was at Go Bananas, and Alex Stone went up after a guy who, old guy. I mean, this guy was old.
Tell me, does he wear a suit, and sometimes he has a little piece of paper with him?
No, wasn't that old.
Okay, all right.
He wasn't as old as time.
Oh, all right.
This guy was short and just old. And he was doing like library joke kind of book, like long form story, super pussy kind of jokes.
Oh, right.
And Alex Stone went up afterwards. He was like, I think he lives in New York now. He was like the golden child of the Go Bananas, I think. Was like, hey, guess what you're going to get now? A bunch of jokes that I didn't research at the library or whatever, that I didn't get out of a library book. And, like, comics went nuts, and the rest of the audience was like, why is he picking on the old guy?
Yeah.
And I thought to myself,
doesn't
like,
no matter where he got jokes, yeah, funny jokes are funny.
I thought
jokes.
That's where you guys all got your jokes.
Yeah.
See, so I want to be a comedian, so did I just go, like, I read a book and it tells me the jokes and I just pick out the ones I want to.
I was in an Uber and this guy's like, you should do a lot of Louis C.K.'s jokes. He's funny. I'm like, really?
Because I don't want a career or anything in this. I'd like to get kicked out of the business.
I think in his head, it was like, you just say things that are funny, don't matter where it came, like being a cover band or whatever. I don't know.
I do think a lot of people think that way about comedy. And I think also some people think that we just come up with it off the top of our head. And sometimes some of it is and some of it isn't.
I like people that think that.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. I think when you're doing it right, it should look
easy. That's what it should look. It should look like you just, And that's, I don't know, that's what your act is. But for me, that's mine. It looks like I'm just talking.
Sure. You have a very conversational style. I think I have a very, but when I started, people said I was very smooth. But now I've been greatly influenced by my heroes, who are people who are more emotive on stage. And I like to get, I like to perform in 3D now, which is something I never thought I would. I always said, like, I'd watch Chris Rock and I'd be like, that looks like too much work.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But now that I have the muscles, I want to work. I mean, I want to leave it on stage.
You know what I mean?
I don't want to come off stage with, like, I got all this energy and stuff. I want to come off like James Brown with a towel over my shoulder. I mean, I'm not there, but I always thought, like, I want to be a comedian because I don't want to work hard. You know what I mean? But then I think a lot of people fall into that trap, so they don't write and they smoke pot and they don't do anything that they're supposed to do. But they're like, but I'm a comedian. I perform 5 times a week. It's like, for free.
Yeah.
You perform 5 times a week.
And
you can get trapped in that, especially in a bigger city like Chicago. The open mic circuit there could have you working 2 shows a night, 7 days a week, without ever picking up any money.
Yeah.
And you would feel, for all intents and purposes, just like a working comic.
Yeah.
Because it's not like the quality of the shows. That's the one thing I'd say the biggest myth I thought once I started getting paid was that the shows would get better.
Oh, you go down. Yeah.
I mean, you hit some new lows.
You go like this, not getting paid. You're at a suit high. You're really enjoying the show. A lot of fun. And then, like, oh, I got a paid one out at the VFW and wherever. And you're like, holy, this sucks.
Right.
This feels like work. And then it's like, well, that's what, like, you kind of do this sort of.
The thing is, once you start relying on it as your income, then what you are able to, and I was never in the business of saying no to anything.
Yeah.
I took on sort of like a yes man mentality when I started doing comedy, to say yes to everything I could unless I was already booked. But now I'm just starting to say no to stuff, or not even say no, but just pass on stuff that I am open for, that I know how I'm going to feel no matter how good the show is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm going to feel like shit driving 5 hours and 5 hours back when it's only going to pay for my gas, even if I sell 5 shirts. Is it really worth trip for your mental health? And so it's easier to say no to some of that stuff. But I drove up to Cadillac, Michigan, fucking the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania, for $100. Flew into Pennsylvania one time for $100 because I had frequent flyer miles that were going to expire and had to rent a car. I mean, I lost $80 to do the gig, but I had a great fucking time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, that's the rub. It's like, even when it's not financially feasible, it's still almost always the best job I've ever had.
Yeah, I'm saying, it's like, what are you going to spend your money on? Like, what do you want
to
do?
Or your
like,
time.
Yeah. I think sometimes, even like, this festival-wise, I basically broke even. I had, like, because if I didn't stay in London for 2 weeks and spend all kinds of money having fun, I probably would have broken even. But that was 6 week vacation of everything I want. I love doing comedy. It's not, and my life isn't necessary. I don't need a real vacation because my life's a vacation.
Exactly. I say that all the time.
And, so it's really, even if you go do an amazing show and you break even, you want, you know?
Yeah. That's the thing. That's my biggest thing now is like, my first couple of years was like, say yes to everything. And then it was like, then I kind of started putting some holds in place where I was like, well, is it a break-even scenario?
Yeah.
You know? And then I started thinking, like, next year I'll be like, it's got to be making money. But I think I'm going to always be in this break-even scenario because I think that's where you have to stay until you start bringing your own crowd.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I've worked with guys who are on a door deal who didn't, you know, for a week, for 6 shows, sold 60 tickets. Yeah. It's like, wah-ha.
Yeah. But even though, let's say you're always looking to make money. Because I think I'm getting to the point now, before I used to, even the type of show that I thought, this isn't my audience at all, but I'll cater the set to try to make them like me.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing feels worse than when you change who you are and they still hate you.
And they still hate you.
And
God damn, that's a fucking,
yeah,
that's a real poignant observation.
So I think I've gotten to the point where I'm like, I know what I want to do when I want to build the kind of audience that gets what I'm doing, and for the most part it's slow and steady race, but and I'll still do some things I don't want to do to make money with this life, but
I'm still turning tricks.
If I wanted to just do that all the time, I could make a lot more money, but I would but then why not just get a day job, because you're already doing something you don't want to do. So
I think I made that agreement with myself a long time ago. Well, I mean, really, when I got it out of, when I stopped working at the restaurant, I started doing comedy. I was going to school full time, and I realized when I was going to school and I was still, there might be an edit. Anyway, I realized that there's no joy in doing it for someone else.
Yeah.
We all work for someone else, but when you have to show up and wear their clothes and say their lines, I was dying. You know what I mean? Like, I literally had to get out of that restaurant because I was giving away the best part of me for such a small amount of money.
Nothing.
Almost, I mean, like, so much time for so little money. And I was one of the highest paid people with the most responsibility in the company. I mean, I was, for all intents and purposes, for a multi-million dollar company, I was like 5 or 6 spots away from the top. And when you can look up the stream and realize, I don't even want any of those jobs.
Yeah.
Then it's like, well, what am I doing here if this isn't everything I wanted out of life?
Yeah.
And I was like, it's not about retirement for me. Like, for me, it's about dying doing what I love. Because,
you're going to sell everything that you are.
Yeah.
Until when you're old, then you can be like, now I can live the life. Now you got to do it in an old man's body.
Yeah.
Like, you've...
Yeah, I have no desire. I could never go back. Now, that's not to say that I could never have a regular type of job. I could just never go back to doing it for someone else. I'd have to be an integral stakeholder in a pizza place. You know what I mean? As an owner, I would have never, I don't know that I'd ever be able to own multiple stores, because as the owner of a business, I believe in being there and being hands-on. I feel like the minute you hire somebody else to carry out your vision starts to die.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think the thing that keeps a lot of these comedy clubs from being more successful then what they should be is not having stakeholders in the clubs running them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you can't watch somebody else's money as well as you can watch your own money.
Yeah.
And I know some of them do have stakeholders, and those seems to be the ones that have the most success.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a mystery or not, or maybe it's the market, but I think, I was thinking on my way down here, that would probably be one of the only things I could do. And I started thinking about like all the things it takes to run a comedy club. And I was like, yeah, that's almost, the last job I had was everything that is except for the comedy part of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the comedy part doesn't make it easier to deal with. That's just one more thing on your shoulders, you know, running a restaurant and then having to book talent.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Dude, that's, I feel like that would be, yeah, because then every single person thinks they can be on that show. Then you're basically just hurting people's feelings all the time. Or
like you were talking about, that's, I think, roundabout point, but you can make more enemies being a gatekeeper.
Oh, I don't want,
you know, of any kind.
Yeah.
Your gate, it could be a fucking picket fence.
All of a sudden, you're taken away from somebody.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you created an opportunity.
Yeah.
And now it's your, it's the opportunity you created.
Yeah.
But also now you're taking that away from someone where it didn't even exist before you were there.
What I would like to do is like contact bookers all across the country and have them send me emails or letters that they've gotten from comics who are blaming them for not getting in or whatever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I read one.
The angriest one. Yeah.
Man, this guy went on to do comedy with us and stuff. I don't think he still does comedy, but he wrote this letter about how they canceled a show, and like because they canceled this show, he's not going to be able to practice for opening for Gabriel Iglesias, and he's also supposed to open for this other guy. And it was just like this.
So you can go back in time and open the show just so you can practice. Like what?
It was just this like fundamental misunderstanding of how comedy works, but almost like lecturing to these people. You know, it's almost like somebody who's like, I know what doctors do, and let me tell you why you're not a good doctor, but, like, none of the shit is based on logic or medicine.
Yeah.
It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I've seen it happen to me one time when I ran a workshop.
Yeah.
I wasn't teaching anything. I set up a format for comedians to bounce jokes off of each other, not where I give them feedback. I didn't even participate in the feedback process of this workshop.
Yeah.
It wasn't a class. It was, they let me, they asked me, would you like to run a workshop here? We used to do it. I said, I got an idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I got from both ends, from the comics that participated, from comics that didn't participate, some of the strangest input I've ever gotten. I got from people how I should have done it, who weren't there. The people that were there.
That's my favorite kind of people.
Yeah.
Is the ones that would tell you how to do it, but they're not going to get involved.
People told me that I shouldn't have done it at all because I wasn't, I was too new to comedy to be running any kind of a work. I was like, I wasn't teaching anybody anything.
Yeah.
I facilitated a place for a guy who had more experience than me to talk. And then we bounced some jokes off of each other.
Yeah.
But that was the thing that I realized, like, this one guy was telling me, like, he has the opportunity to do comedy at the Schuster Center. And that's what he would like to focus on. And I said, well, look, buddy, I said, I hope you get to do comedy at the Schuster Center. I said, but I'm kind of like a Funny Bone employee, kind of like a Wiley's employee.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a comedy employee. And that means not going against the grain of the set established methodology of how a comic starts at an open mic or a bar show. And then they start working that club. And then after 15 or 25 years, they book a theater show in the Schuster Center because they can't, their draw is too big to hold the club.
Yeah.
I have no interest in trying to book a first-time comic in the Schuster Center.
Unless you got a lot of family.
Unless your last name is Belushi slash...
Yeah. Your name's Dick Pryor.
Yeah.
You can make it work.
It was one of those, it was my first, but then I also realized like, I was talking to a crazy person.
Yeah, yeah.
He was maybe not certifiable, like needs to be institutionalized or anything like that, but
not all the wires were shooting in the right places. Yeah.
And I knew that when I saw him at the workshop because like certain people just like, well, one person in particular just refused to interact with him.
Yeah.
He just like turned his back on him. And I was like, okay, both of those guys are a problem. Because part of being in comedy is having to talk to people that you find,
Yeah,
you know, untalkatuable.
Yeah.
Even if it, and the only this exercise was for 1 minute, 1 minute each way. You know, so 2 minutes total. If you can't face somebody, for 2 minutes, that says more about you as a human being than it does as a comic, I think. But I always thought, like, you know, we're big on judgment as comics. But I don't know where that stops. Where does it stop for you?
What, on where?
Like, on how much you're judging somebody. Because, like, I think we judge people, like, sometimes you're like, can you believe this guy's doing jokes like this? And then sometimes it's like, yeah, he's 6 months in. This is exactly the kind of jokes
I'm
doing.
I'm fine with that. I'm fine. My thing, and it's not a judgment for just the sake of judgment. Like, it's really, like, when you see someone that's been at it for, like, 6 to 10 years, and they're just doing, like, just talking. Like, or really, like, it's just, it's either terrible, or they've been in the same jokes forever, or they're not really saying anything or trying to say anything. My judgment is I look at them and I go, is their delusion reflect my own delusion? Like, that's what I, like, that's where I, because at first I used to be like, what are you doing with your life? But then I think, like, am I that guy? Am I him? Is that, a, you know, but.
I think it's a little bit of both, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you almost always see a little bit of yourself in every comic on stage. I heard somebody say this the other day. I think it was Chris Allen was talking to him. And he said, Jamie Foxx said it. He said, the reason why we have such a hard time watching comics bomb and crush is because we think the audience is our bitch. Yeah. And we see somebody else fucking with our bitch. And we're like, I mean, whether it's a woman or a man or, you know, we think of the audience as being ours and somebody else is fucking it up or doing stuff to it. Like, I don't make my wife scream like that. You know what I mean? Kind of a situation. I thought that was a really interesting analogy because that, in essence of that, insight is that we are putting ourselves in the shoes of the person on stage and realizing we are not equal to them in some way, shape, or form. Either we're saying we're better than them or they're better than us, and it's scary. But yeah, I try to reserve my judgment. Like you were saying,
sometimes I don't like, I feel like, not necessarily it's like they're chasing off the audience or whatever else, but like I don't like someone like just screwing up my sport. Like someone up there that just, now that I love more when someone's like, well, I don't really have much else. Like just cause you, maybe you got booked for 10 minutes, but you don't have 10 minutes. Get the hell off there. You're done. You did your, don't just waffle around. And like, that's when I just like, you're now you're just being an asshole. Really.
Yeah. I kind of agree with that. And I know comics that are like, will show up to a contest, the finals of a contest and say, and I know one comic in particular who's done this more times than I can count. And say, I don't even know what I'm going to talk about. You know, I don't really know what I'm going to do. And I'm thinking to myself, and that's why you're not going to win.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's very, very simple to do 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I know what 5 minutes I'm going to do if somebody hands me a microphone when I walk into the gas station.
Yeah, yeah.
I know what, I mean, and I realized, I saw it in Jay Snyder. His opening 4 minutes has pretty much always been the same.
Yeah.
No matter how many times you've seen him, he tells you who he is and what he's about. And then from there, it's wide open field.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, well, I don't want to say the same thing every time. But then I heard Daniel Tosh tell Bert Kreischer, he's like, it's not your job to write new material. It's your job to get good at telling the material you already have.
Yeah.
So then there comes the, how much material should I have? And I think that's the age old question for every comic. And so when I tell new comics is, you should do a new set every time unless your first set fucking kills.
Yeah.
And then you do it a second time and you realize it's not as funny as you thought it was the first time, or they realize it's not as funny as you thought it was the first time, or whatever, until you start realizing, like, okay, till you can pick out what jokes aren't working, it doesn't really matter. Because I think you can't really judge how funny you are until you've performed 100 times. Yeah. Open mics,
or
bar
even
shows.
What you are on stage. Like, you have a picture of who you are.
Yeah. But most people have a picture of that before they ever even perform for the first time.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that's what you are. That's what you view. Like, I mean, you, like I said, you have to do it for a while to get, I mean, it's still, I'm still learning that as well. Like, you get up there and you're like, this is what's funny for me, to me, to them, this, I can connect to them with this. This joke will personify who I am as a person, so this next bit will work perfectly, and where I can go this direction because they heard me say this thing, and they, you know what I mean? Like, that's an ongoing forever process. And because you see people that have stuck with their first little, I got a little laugh out of this in the beginning, I'm sticking with that joke.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's a matter of, and like, if you, it took you 5 minutes before to personify your bit, to set it up before, and you're able to get that down to two real strong minutes.
Yes.
Now that's, now you're, it just, it's a cake that's never finished. Like, you're always.
Yeah, because you can, it's like a layer cake, right? Because you can change the different layers. You can add, you can thin them out. You can add more frosting, more meat to the cake. I did a thing at, Doug Morgan did this show at Falcon Club, which is like a private, it's like a BFW kind of a club, but not BFW. And he did like a potluck at the beginning where any comics that showed up could do a 1 minute set, like a speed round or whatever. And so like five of us went up and did 1 minute. And what I noticed was I was timing people and most comics only did like 20 to 30 seconds, but still got out a couple of jokes. And I was like, I know that joke, you just trimmed it down.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, so that's what I'll do. Like, Doug, I'm gonna go up. He's like, all right, cool. I was like, I was like, but I gotta headline this part. I gotta do a headline the 1 minute. I'm gonna do a minute and a half. But I was able to get three jokes out that I usually take 5 minutes to tell all three jokes, and I told all three of them in 1 minute, and they got as big or bigger response with all the frosting and cake mix missing.
Yeah, you took all it was the just fluff the essence. Off
it. Yeah, and I realized that that was what my existential problem was when I first started featuring was. How do I take these jokes that I have and make them longer?
Yeah, yeah.
And now I'm thinking, like, how do I take this joke and make it better?
How do I get to the, I got to get the point to A to B as quick as possible.
It doesn't always have to be as quick as possible because some jokes...
are not quick, but is with as less fluff.
Sure, sure.
And like more that's meat. One thing I liked about this festival is you have my show from the first week to the last week. You go every day, you're like, it's between this maybe like 10 minutes and 15 minutes. They're sort of listening, but not laughing. What do I got to move this around? Do I need this? Do I need to say this part first? Do I even need to say this part?
Right.
Like, I mean, in a regular conversation, we don't have, and here's our transition to talking about shoes. We just, somebody just said, hey, look at that guy. And now you're talking about that. The audience isn't stupid. Like, you start figuring out, like, but yeah, you can audit it down to make it as punchy yet as poignant as possible.
The day after day after day after day, I think you would naturally start to whittle away at the part, almost like, if you were like on a desert island and all you had to eat was like 12 things and one of the things kept making you sick.
Yeah.
It's like, it's going to be pretty quick with only these 12 things that you're eating. You're going to figure out pretty quickly which one's making you sick and you can leave that one out of your diet. And I think that's the beautiful part of like having something be that free form and long going and open to that many people.
And you can do, I'll say the one thing that was nice is doing, you don't have that many little, a lot of people run little compilation shows up there, so you can do a 10 so many times during the day, or you could write a new 5 and then in the course of about 4 or 5 days, because you're able to go on stage that many times and it could crush one place and die in the next, and you're like, try this and move it around.
And that's the hardest part, right? Because like you were saying earlier, each audience is different. And so like what worked for one audience, the same exact joke might totally turn off another.
So for me, that was the best thing about, because for here, like, let's say you want to try to write a new bit, you might be like, I mean, what, Dayton's got 2 open mics or it's got, and even theirs have no audience, they're just other comics, and comics don't laugh at the thing people laugh at, and then you were going to go to Columbus or whatever else. Like, what you would do in the course of 2 to 3 weeks, you can do in like 2 days. And that was the kind of that's what made it fun, really.
I think that that's what's most appealing about it to me, because when I watched Hannibal Buress's like documentaries kind of special about it or whatever, I was like, that looks really depressing.
He, well, okay, I'll say about, actually, I met him there the year he did that. He had spaghetti at our place and then didn't thank anybody and sat on his phone the whole time and then left. I still like him as a comic, but I guess I'm not, I don't know what it means to process that level of fame, so I can't really. So I give that
That's an honest assessment.
And I would probably not like talking to people either.
I always wonder at what point that comes about, or like the point where you come, where you start telling people, like when people are like, what do you do? And you're like, I'm a businessman. You know what I mean? Instead of a comedian. Cause like, I don't, I just started becoming aware of is like, who am I saying this to? Who's asking? And it's almost like, if it's somebody that I don't mind carrying a conversation with, or I don't think I would mind, then I just tell them the truth. But I recently realized that like, I can't, I have a hard time lying about it. So like when somebody's like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, as little as possible. You know, I mean, I just try to play it off and get out of the conversation or whatever. But if it really, if they press, I always end up telling them. But it's one of those things that I think that...
Sometimes I'll just say I do handyman stuff.
Jack of all trades, master of none.
Well,
today I did, I don't know what... I know some guys that are like, that would never admit to it. If somebody asked them. And I think part of it's because...
tell me a joke or some stupid thing.
They're tired of the same response.
It's of no benefit to...
There really is no benefit, because it's almost like saying I'm a I'm a wizard.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a wizard.
Do some magic.
Because then people are like, wow, what's that like? What's it like being a wizard? Yeah. And it's not nearly as interesting as being a wizard, I imagine. I don't know any wizards, but I imagine it's just that my thought of being a wizard, I don't know if wizards are like, nah, this shit's the best. You know what I mean? Like, it's really the best job in the world.
Conjure fire.
Yeah. You have a conjure fire on your enemies, dog. But that's kind of how I feel about being a comedian. It's like I don't know. I don't want to really tell you what it's like to be a comedian, because then you're just going to want to be one.
Or you'll
think that you are one, or you could be one. But
you're going to tell me, you're going to think you... Well, one thing I say with him, that's special, is he made the festival look bad. He clearly had no understanding of what he was doing, and I feel like he made himself look bad.
Uh-huh.
Like he made, which I understand he's just a crotchety dude, that's his, what his persona is.
Yeah.
But it seemed like he made no attempt to cater or change his... or change his set at all for the audience he was in front of. Or not saying that you necessarily have to do that, but culturally, they're different people.
Right.
And, like, I watched Louis C.K. just die on his hole in Kilkenny. And, or, like, Dom Marrero was doing, like, Jews do this and Italians do this. It's like, you're in Ireland, dude. They have no idea what you're talking about, man. It doesn't mean they're dumb.
It's a contextual thing.
Yeah, like, I wouldn't come in here and talk about the difference between, like, working class East London and without any sort of explanation of it.
Sure.
And that, and the shows they put him on were shows that comics in the UK, like TV pro comics, have been fighting for years. He just walks in on them, and he's complaining about, like, so it makes Americans look like just whiny, entitled. And the one he was on was called Late in Live, which the point of that show is it's insane. Like, it's a bear pit, and you're fighting with the audience.
Right.
And he's like, what is this garbage show? Everyone's just yelling at me. It's like, do you have no idea what this show has been like that for about 20 years now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, they're like, okay, everyone be quiet because Hannibal doesn't want to do it like the rest. I don't know. So that part, but the one part I really liked was the last minute of it. He goes, well, I guess I'll just go back to America and keep making millions of dollars.
Yeah. Oh, damn. And I really wanted to be successful here.
Yeah.
That's, I was listening to him more recently. He's not really my kind of comedy, but at the same time, it's not that he's not my kind of comedy.
Yeah.
It's just, it's like kind of on the cusp of what I find really interesting and also really kind of niche. I mean, his fans are his fans, and I like that he's doing his thing. He's not trying to be like some other kind of comic, especially as a black comic. I think that's really important, and I don't want to say like, well, black comics really need to differentiate themselves. I mean, all comics need to figure out their own thing.
Yeah, but no, I know exactly what you're saying. It's, you already think, because they even have this, which always annoyed the shit of me, like, what's a black comedy night?
Yeah,
what the hell does that mean?
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. Everyone got to talk about death.
Yeah,
this is black night.
Yeah,
I struggle with that, as you know, being biracial. I think it's because I find the topic of race to be so close to my it's always on my tongue. Now, in reality, I'm not thinking about race all the time, but kind of I am. But
still,
for some
America,
reason,
how do you not?
Yeah, I mean, for some reason, it if I'm writing jokes, like, it seems to be that it's going to creep into one of the angles in some way, shape, or form. And I'm realizing, like, that's just who I am. And I can't really apologize for that. I just have to figure out my take on it. And it doesn't have to be right, but it does have to be honest and truthful.
Yeah. But I think that, because what you're talking about is your perspective in the world.
Right.
And that's different than, like, the sort of style where you're like, just call
black
some,
people be white people be
look at this guy's shirt, he's gay,
you know what I mean,
dumb shit, like I'm not saying it's
people.
All but some of it, like where it's all performance over material
substance. And there's something to be said for that, and I think especially when it comes to, like you were saying, performing for an international audience or people that don't necessarily get our tropes and cliches, the performance of that act can overcome the misunderstanding of some of those cliches, but at the same time, neither one of those two things can carry the whole act. It's like a balancing act of some sort.
Because there is a slight, I know, at least with me personally, there's things I did. I noticed when I came this way, certain things worked in a way that they over there that didn't work here. And then coming back, I was like, oh, I've gotten too American almost. And then I felt that in London.
It's
they sort of appreciate more, like, if there's a joke that's got two things happening at the same time and all this sort of stuff.
Clever.
Whereas here, it pisses people off sometimes.
Yeah.
They're just like, what are you trying to trick my head? Like,
Get out of my brain, you ignorant man.
Yeah.
I've definitely dealt with that. Whereas people would say to me, like, when I first started, they were like, he's got very smart comedy. And I was thinking to myself, like, these are still dick jokes. You know what I mean? This is nothing about this is smart to me. You know what I mean? Nothing about this is smart. And I think what it is that what they were saying is sort of like Obama. He's clean. He's articulate. It's like for a black guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not. It's not. But I think also part of what it is that I have a pretty. I wouldn't say severe, but I have a pretty severe case of inferiority complex. So I'm overcompensating with the way that I speak so that people don't think I'm stupid. But that's because I think I'm stupid. You know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't really matter how dumb you think I am. Nobody thinks I'm dumber than me.
I would say everyone does that with something in their life.
Sure. Yeah. We're all overcompensating or even undercompensating to some degree to make it okay. But I think that's what was coming across in my comedy when I first started. It may still be there, but even to this day, the best compliment anybody ever gives me, it's not buying a t-shirt, it's not shaking my hand after a show, it's just when they walk out after the show and they go, because that's all I've ever wanted is for somebody to be like, you're smart. When they laugh, that's all I hear. Like, you're not totally stupid, even if I'm getting a laugh from being totally stupid.
I think that's a good place to be. That's a good thing to,
I mean, I think you got to kind of know what your vice is. And the easier you are able to satiate the demons, the healthier you are at satiating your demons, the better you are at dealing with your vices.
But also, I think that speaks to, you know what you want out of comedy and you know what you want out of that experience. And if that's the compliment you like, when someone, you touch someone intellectually, you're like, that's the people. I want someone who gets that.
Yeah. I tend to write into that. Yeah, I tend to write for those people. And I also...
Sometimes you could write a joke and they're laughing at the wrong parts.
Yes.
And you're like, no, that's not the joke, dick. Like,
yeah.
You're not.
That nigger joke is hilarious, man.
Or I'll do a joke with a funny accent. They're laughing. It's like, you're not listening to what they're saying. You're just laughing at... That's part of the joke.
Yeah.
But that isn't the joke. You resent them for not laughing at the right part or something.
Yeah, you're laughing for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And there's something to be said for that. Doing well accidentally or... I've had all types of people totally misrepresent. I had a guy one time come up. I just started doing comedy maybe a year and a half. And he was like, yeah, man, I thought you were funny, but the biracial stuff is a little bit... I didn't really like it. I said, oh, yeah, well, it was a white guy. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I was kind of thinking to myself, like... Why didn't he like it? But I was also kind of thinking, like, well, I didn't write it for you then. You know what I mean? If you didn't find it funny. And he was like, yeah, I got a daughter. She's got a couple biracial kids. You know, and I didn't really appreciate it. And I said, you did get that I'm biracial,
though, right?
I was like, well, you should bring those kids. I bet they fucking love it.
And he was like, but they love it more than you.
I was like, I was performing at a gay bar in Springfield. Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? I'm like, this is supposed to be, like, open. You know, at the very least. And I just realized at that moment, like, not everyone's going to like, you know. And I think also we live in a time now where we're listening to be offended sometimes. Certain people are.
Yeah,
as soon as they hear a word, sometimes, no matter what the context, you hear this, like, you know.
Or they like that feeling of offense.
Yeah.
Because it gives them their righteous indignation.
Yeah. It's so weird. It's almost like when I start to feel offended, I feel alive.
And I say this to many people because I'm about as liberal as Castro, minus the murder, really. Mm-hmm. But I find a lot of times liberal audiences, like-minded people, to be, you barely touch on a subject, you go that way, and you can hear that, just them sucking in air, and it's like, let me finish the joke first before, you
know. Extremism knows no political affiliation.
It's just extreme. Like I said, even as a liberal, I'll say there's a lot of liberals that, they just love righteous indignation, and that's why we've isolated so many people, because we just getting mad because I'm so much smarter than you.
Yeah.
And how dare you?
It's this thing. It's like, well, I have an open mind, so I'm right.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that's not
what that
is. Just negated what having an open mind means.
Yeah. Your teacup is full.
Yeah.
Pour any more tea into that cup.
Yeah. But well, this has been fascinating conversation with you, Luke. Why don't you plug your handles? What are you, your social medias?
I'm on YouTube as Luke Capasso. I'm on I got a Facebook fan page as Luke Capasso, and Twitter is also Luke Capasso.
What about your driver's license?
That is Juan Valdez.
From Colombia.
I'm actually in the Dreamer program, so I might not be here.
It's a Class D license, D for donkey.
Yeah.
D for donkey.
Yeah.
What about shows coming up? What you got?
I got on the 23rd after, I should have booked it sooner, but I'm going to do, because that's what I was doing the Edinburgh thing for, is the training for that. I'm going to record my album. I'm actually just going to do it in the Art Center in the Yellow Springs.
Oh, the nice Art Center. Yeah. I love that place.
Oh, dude, that should be, someday, my dream is for that to go under and I can buy it.
Turn it into a comedy club.
That back room is perfect comedy
club. It is. It's,
I want to connect it to Peaches, and Peaches can do the booze. I don't just want to.
Right out the back door. Yeah, just did a little alleyway there. Yeah. I did a show there. We did it outside, but we were like, well, what if we have to, if it rains, we'll have to come inside. And I was like, we have to come inside. We'll have to charge ticket prices because it literally hold 50 people maybe?
Yeah.
30.
I want to just open that side door and then.
That place is magical. We did our show outside on the stage. It was one of the best. It was the best outdoor show I've ever been a part of. Mm-hmm. And why I don't do shows in Yellow Springs. I mean, like, not do shows, but won't book another show in Yellow Springs. And not to say that I never would, but that show was so good that I'm convinced
That town's done.
Anything else that I have a part in, as far as booking, it just have to be less than that.
Yeah.
Which is not the truth. It's just my fear.
Yeah, no, I know.
But
what you mean.
It's kind of like, I'm good. I'm good right now. But I think also that's like the folly of a lot of comics is the first thing they do, their first open mic, and they're like, I could run a show. I should run a show. Yeah. I'm going to run a show in my hometown.
Yeah.
Which is like, I'm all for all those things. But that last statement, in your hometown, that's one of the, I might not be the best place to start.
A huge turnout for your first one, and then no one.
And
again.
Then watch it
and
all.
People will avoid eye contact.
Exactly.
And think you want something.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And most people that start a show, is starting a show is just like doing your first open mic. It's like your first show is not going to be what it could have been if you knew what you were doing.
Yeah. So I always tell people, you should, I know it sounds like unpaid intern thing, but you should ask someone if you can help them and actually help them and do it and then run a show.
Exactly. There's a lot more goes into it than
just putting a mic somewhere.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's almost, you know, when you first start doing comedy, it's like having sex. It's like, we could do this anywhere. Let's do it everywhere. You know, I can't get enough of this. And reality is, you're not hurting anybody by doing shows, bad shows in the wrong places. You're really not hurting anyone other than your own self-esteem and the self-esteem of the people that come to do the show. Yeah. It's not a global mistake. It's not ruining comedy. It's just a necessary evil because for every bad comedian out there, there's 10 bad accountants.
Yeah.
For every bad open micer out there, there's 10 bad people cutting hair who shouldn't be cutting hair because they don't have a license or experience.
Yeah.
Fucking up a haircut. In comedy, we think it's different, but it's the same. It's 10% of the people doing 90% of the work and the 0.01% of them doing it perfectly. Everybody else trying. Mm-hmm. Well, that's my take on it.
Yeah.
I got nothing coming. I'll be at Dayton Funny Bone this weekend, hosting for Benji Brown and a feature act who I yet to have discovered. But last year at this exact same time, I was in Orlando featuring for Benji Brown. A week of the worst shows of my life. Thursday was okay and Sunday was good, but Friday and Saturday was the bane of my existence. The only thing that made it worthwhile was I got to hang out with Doug Benson on Friday and Saturday, and then which turned into me getting to be able to do Doug Loves Movies a couple weeks ago here in Columbus.
Oh,
so
nice.
Worth it. But I took this gig. I got my pick of like three different weekends, and I picked this one because I knew it, of the other ones, this would be the most challenging.
Yeah.
And I was like, not that I'm gonna get to redeem myself as an MC, but. I can redeem myself as an MC in my own mind.
Like you were saying before, if you kill it somewhere, you don't want to go there again. But
exactly.
If I die somewhere, I want to go back there as soon as possible.
I need to get back on the horse.
Yeah.
which is why I can't quit heroin. Yeah. But no,
yeah, it's
no.
just so good.
It's just so good. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Sorry it's been so long. I'll be better. I'm trying to do better. Love you. Stay related.
Loving arms, I'll be there.